welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is William Cook. Bill is a writer, he's an author, he's a professor of English at the University of Laverne in California. He earlier served as a vice president for academic affairs for 13 years. His books include Cultural Expressions of Evil and Wickedness, Psalms for the 21st Century, and an edited one titled The Plight of the Palestinians. His newest is titled Decades of Deceit, 2002 to 2012. Bill, it's great to have you back on the program today. I wish we could get together on here someday when we could talk about all the wonderful things going on around the world, especially in the most troubled areas. I don't think I'll live long enough to see that, Bill.
And I don't think I will either, Steve. The wonderful things, that's an oxymoron.
It really
is. How are
you
doing, Steve?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. I mean, these horrific events keep me busy writing about them, and I've got a couple of articles I'll put out tomorrow. Another one on Guantanamo. I've written so much about Guantanamo. This one I go to a great extent, citing organizations, human rights organizations, and ones related to them, just condemning the force feeding that's going on. Also, Washington, Obama, is waging an imperial war, proxy war against Syria. I've got another article about that, and I quote extensively from an interview that the Syrian president gave to two Argentinian news agencies. I'm not familiar with them, and of course they publish there in Spanish, but I got an English translation, so I commented extensively on that. But this is the kind of stuff that goes on. Well, you understand the Middle East very well, Bill. You've certainly written enough about it.
Well, yes, I have. You remember when the Arab Spring first got underway and you and I were on the radio and talking about what is the large picture in terms of the expectations of the West relative to what is going to happen in the Mideast itself? And we, at that time, noted, obviously, that there was a bit of a surprise when the Egyptians rose up and took control of their own country. And America and Israel were in very difficult times trying to figure out what it is that we have to do now to make sure that the purpose that we have in establishing a separate state in the Mideast, armed to the teeth, can continue to exist. At that point, they were suggesting that Suleiman could go in and replace Mubarak and that kind of thing. But what we realize, I think, now, looking back at the past year, is that the West has kind of consolidated what it intends to do in order to make sure that it has not lost control and people somehow in the North African population get control of their own governments and are not as interested in being puppets or dictators controlling them run by the West. That, I think, is becoming more and more obvious. And they thought that they had Libya under control, and obviously Libya is not under control. They thought that eventually the Brotherhood that took over in Egypt would capitulate to their needs, but now we've noticed that Morsi is not going to obey the West as readily as Mubarak. We have seen the uprisings in Bahrain and Yemen. We've seen stirrings in Morocco. The Mali affair adds to that, Algeria. Each of these areas have moved in directions that are forcing the West, and we're talking now about France and Britain and the United States and Israel predominantly wanting to reassert a way of taking control on the basis of freedom and democracy. The reality is that it's not free and it's not democratic that they want to achieve, there is an agenda that is present. And quite frankly, Steve, I think if you look at the way in which the West has taken control, trying to put these sanctions into place, and through that means affect their will, it's not working particularly well, especially when the EU has just opened the doors on oil shipments and removed the sanction preventing that from Syria. So now we have something of a conflict of interest taking place there, and it's going to be interesting to see how this proposed conference of Russia and the West evolves. If you look at it carefully, it seems to me that the forces that the U.S. will now confront will have to include, because Russia will make the demands that it include, a way in which Iran has to be present at such a conference. China, of course, has a great interest in what's taking place in Syria as well. And then you look at the forces that are aligned with the West, and it's a strange group of religious rightists, extremists, including Al-Qaeda, jihadists, and others that are working in Syria not to bring democracy and freedom, but to overthrow Assad. And perhaps, depending on which of these groups ends up being the final recognized one that the West will agree to, it could be that we'll be supporting things like the religious right coming out of the extremist jihadist group. This is a confusing time, and it's going to be interesting to see how this all evolves.
Oh, Bill, there is so much I could say from the great review of what you commented on, beginning with the Arab Spring to what's going on in Syria right now. I was asked by a Press TV producer, about a week or so ago, to write an article about the Middle East, I reviewed, I believe it was 8 countries, if I have my count right. It's for an Iranian publication. I forget the name he mentioned to me, but he said virtually all the political people in the country read this publication, and what I wrote would be published in Farsi. I asked him if he'd send me a copy, even though I can't read Farsi. But I reviewed all of these countries. I could sum it up very easily by saying the so-called Arab Spring that began over 2 years ago in the winter of 2011, virtually nothing has changed. You know, the names and faces change, but the policies same in place. So you could sum it up saying everything changed the same. Everything changed but remained the same. And you can see it. It began in Tunisia. There were protests. I don't know if they're every day, but there have been a number of street protests in Tunisia, and that's where the Arab Spring began. The Egyptians have been protesting very, very vehemently, and they're the one. They got rid of Mubarak, but they may have gotten something worse than him in return. The Syrian war, of course, rages out of control. This is Washington's war. The so-called peace conference that America and Russia agreed to, I absolutely see no chance of it succeeding. You remember the Kofi Annan peace plan, Bill, and the and the Geneva conference a year ago, this coming June. The language out of the Kofi Annan's plan was absolutely one-sided on the side of the insurgents. It was a disgraceful plan, 5 or 6 points in it. It barely masked the agenda that he serves. The same with Ban Ki-moon now, their imperial tools. And the language out of the Geneva convention, the language was wonderful, Bill, but the policy after it was absolutely diverted from it, subverted it, made there be no chance of succeeding on a diplomatic, peaceful way. So you get the nice rhetoric now. Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov said the right things when they were together. Well, Lavrov, I think, means it. All along, Russia's wanted a diplomatic solution to this thing, and Kerry pretty much mouthed the same sentiment. And then he gets back to Washington, or wherever he went after leaving Moscow, and the first thing out of his mouth was, Assad has to go.
That's right. Well, they have their agenda nailed, and it's a question that because they haven't got a predetermined dictator to stick in, they don't know who to pay yet to take on their mantle. There's a lot of confusion here. And Obama is not in a situation to enter a war that's going to include 84 roughly million Iranians, all the Syrians and their troops, the Russian ships in the Persian Gulf and close by, and the interests of China with the oil needs that it has somehow aligned against him, and we're in debt to the trillions of dollars. There is no way in which the American people can take on this kind of conflagration, which, in fact, it would of necessity be. You just need to look at the map to realize that. You know, I had an article out this week that is kind of a different way of trying to perceive the problems, and it's called Daddy, What is a Drone? A Bedtime Story. Did you get a chance to look at that at all?
I didn't, Bill. I didn't. Maybe you can send me a link to it.
Well, it's a curious little story. What I tried to do, obviously, was to turn attention to this one decision on the part of Obama, which is, in my mind, totally unexplainable, that he would sit down on Tuesday nights with his enlightened group of advisors and decide which people he will kill and which he will let continue to live until the next Tuesday or the Tuesday after that. And this then has his daughter, who would have heard somewhere along the way about a drone, and she asked the question, what is a drone? The question jolted him out of his lethargy as he suddenly sat upright in the soft chair he had slumped into when she came for her time with Daddy. It had the ring of a catechism question. What is God, Daddy? How does one answer that without a torrent of other questions cascading from this innocent mouth one after another? His first impulse was to ignore it, his second to discombobulate the response with obfuscation, to deflect the question with words she could not understand. His third, to respond directly to her question, to speak the truth, knowing that she would not comprehend the intricacies of the policies that legalize the use of drones. He remembered the story of Hawthorne's good Dr. Grimm, who had to address a similar question when little Ned asked him, whence came I here and why? Indeed, the good doctor answered honestly, truthfully, bluntly, and dare we say it wisely. Whence did you come? Whence did any of us come? Out of the darkness and mystery, out of nothingness, out of a kingdom of shadows, out of dust, mud, clay, I think, and to return to it again. Out of a former state of being whence we have brought a good many shadowy revelations purporting that it is not a very pleasant one. Out of a former life of which the present one is hell. And why are you come? Faith, Ned, he must be a wiser man than Dr. Grimm, who can tell you why you or any other mortal came hither. Only one thing I'm well aware of, it was not to be happy. To toil and moil and hope and fear, and to love in a shadowy, doubtful sort of way, and to hate in bitter earnest. That is what you came for.
Oh, indeed, Bill. Indeed, Bill. That is very moving stuff, indeed, from dust to dust. But, you know, we come into this world with no idea what the devil we're going to be facing. And I think about it, and I say it, I repeat it to others, that I'm really glad I'm not young today, because it is as imperfect as the world was that I grew up in, that you grew up in, it is so much worse today, and the path that we're on, I can only see it getting much, much worse, and I just dread how bad it possibly could be, even the possibility of something approaching World War III. I mean, just the very thought of it sends chills through me, but it's very possible it could happen.
Well, sure, and the thing that this little story, it seems to me, demonstrates is that someone has decided, because at the very end of this little bedtime story, I have the girl say, "Daddy, who tells the computer when to fire a missile? Daddy, why don't these people get arrested and charged with their crimes? Daddy, why don't you use the courts and the laws of the country? Daddy, who is God? Are you God, Daddy? Who made you God, Daddy?" And obviously the purpose of bringing it down to that is that someone, this emperor of the world, has decided that he has the authority to do this kind of thing and to simply trash all the attempts since 1922 to have the nations of the world come together and find a means of living together and to provide avenues in human rights and in justice and in international courts and in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to protect people from this very thing, from those who decide, "I am right, I know what I will do, and if others don't do it, they're wrong. They are terrorists." And it's strange to me that we have allowed definitions of words, this is my business, that we've allowed definitions of words to exclude those who do them. Terrorism is a state rejected opportunity. You cannot be a terrorist if you are a state-run operation. And yet we know from the get-go that the most deplorable examples of terrorism come from states. And so we've excused ourselves from being to blame. And then the people elect governments, whether it's the current one in Egypt or whether it was Hamas years back in Palestine, and we declare Hamas and Hezbollah and Egyptian governments as terrorism, places that allow for terrorism to exist, even though they are elected officials for a given state. This is our way of excusing and defending the most lawless behavior that one can understand to exist in this incredibly lawless world.
Bill, it is so true, and I'm also appalled at the sublime ignorance of the great majority of people in America. In one of my articles I'll put out tomorrow, it's another article on Syria, and I quote from I cite from an end of April New York Times CBS News poll, and it just floored me, Bill, absolutely floored me. It showed an astonishing 90% of Americans believe they'll always have to live with the risk of terrorism, and I state categorically, no terrorist threat whatever exists in America. None. Zero. Anything that's claimed is fabricated. It's made up. America has no enemies. It hasn't had one since the Japanese surrendered on the battleship Missouri in August 1945, and I'm old enough to remember that. I was hoping it would fall on my birthday. I missed by a day or two. I thought there would be a day to end wars to be a day that my birthday falls. I thought that would be a wonderful birthday present to me, but I missed. I came close, but I missed. And then another equally astonishing, 75% of the people polled believed that restricting civil liberties is okay. One-fourth of them said existing policy measures aren't enough. Another near 50% said they're about right. And only 20% said government went too far. So in other words, nearly 80% accept mass surveillance. They accept the fact that they're willing to give up freedom for more security, and they're too out of touch with reality to realize that if you give up freedom for security, you end up losing both. But this is the mentality of most of the people in the country, and it's the reason why America gets away with murder. Nobody challenges policies here. So they
no,
just
they
do whatever
not.
They want.
Yeah. We need to rethink how America should respond to the multiple crises that it has either forced into existence or willingly became a part of. and ask other questions. The kind of question that the child is asking in that story, why? Who made a person God to determine these things? Why do we decide who to kill? Why not ask, who should we help? Why build weapons that protect our soldiers but kill thousands? Why not get rid of weapons and bring food and medical supplies to these people? Why not be motivated by concern, by compassion, for heaven's sakes? Why not be even love, to share the resources with everyone instead of hoarding all to ourselves and be like pack animals ravaging the countryside for self-protection? The better to create the fear that you're talking about that makes control possible. Because that's why it's done. That's why we find, strangely enough, exercises being perpetrated at the time of the Boston Marathon. Why would that be done, Steve? Why do we have exercises to blow up potential places where bombs might exist, and bring dogs that sniff all that stuff out to an event where thousands upon thousands are going to be waiting at a finish line with backpacks for changing of clothes, for water, for the people that finish the race, and they're greeting them and sharing what they've brought in the backpacks. But it turns into a military exercise with 900 some soldiers of various and sundry kinds, from Blackwater mercenaries to the FBI and SWAT teams and CIA, where we house all kinds of other soldiers. It's a very strange thing, but it forces the American people, obviously, to sit down and say, oh, they are protecting us. We need them here. Why do we have exercises like that in events that are supposed to be for joy and fulfillment and the expression of human ability and endurance, and instead it becomes a place of murder and mayhem that creates the kind of climate where we need protection, where the city of Boston, I used to work there at Boston University for years, and the whole state, the whole city and its surrounding areas are shut down, and people can't go anywhere because they have been completely forced and accepting of it, that this is a condition that should prevail.
Well, that's the face of martial law. For so many hours, the city of Boston, the city I grew up in, and I certainly know where the incident took place in Copley Square. I'm very familiar with Boston University. When I got into the Army, Bill, before I went off to the Wharton School, I took a couple of courses, summer courses at BU, and because I got credit for them, an accounting course and another one, and I'm very familiar with the whole area. Grew up in the mid-1950s, and I've only gotten back a few times since then. My family moved away. But again, the city I grew up in turned out to be a city on lockdown, and I wrote plenty about it, Bill, and the fact that what happened in Boston could happen anywhere. It can happen across the country if there's some kind of a staged terror event, another 9/11 or something even greater than that. You can see the whole country go on lockdown. You could see a permanent state of martial law and suspension of the Constitution. And the worst part of it, Bill, is people will think that this is a good thing to do because the government is keeping them safe, and they don't realize that they just have the Constitution trashed. It no longer exists. They've lost all their rights, and who knows what can happen next.
Yeah, that's
and
for
it
sure.
Probably will.
Well, I don't understand the compliance of the people generally, except that they have seen so much in the way of war and presentation of the need to protect the individuals against it, both on television, in the movies, and certainly from such a distance, that any threat becomes as real as the destruction of the Twin Towers. And it has created a mindset that has solidified over time, and we are becoming much more subservient, subjugated almost, to the government and its homeland security in such a way that we do not appreciate what freedom means anymore.
We sure don't. I don't think we understand the meaning of the term, and if Orwell were around today, he certainly would understand it well, and he could explain it, but probably nobody would listen to him or read him. But, I mean, this is really a nightmare coming true, and even the stuff that he imagined over half a century ago, the technology today, I think, goes beyond what he conceived. I mean, it's absolutely incredible where there could be mass surveillance. We literally could be monitored all the time. Our personal information is an open book to the people who want to get their hands on it. Everything, medical, financial, you name it. If you're online, of course, they can tap into you very easily, or in cell phones, but they can bug your telephone. They can do virtually anything, maybe sneak into the place where you live and wire it for sound or video or anything they want. And I mean, this is really Big Brother come to life. It's no longer fiction. It's the real thing. And in my own city of Chicago, Bill, I don't know what the most heavily video camera city is, but Chicago was certainly one of them. There were literally video cameras everywhere, and you can't spot them easily. They can just look like a light fixture. They can be on a lamppost. They can be anywhere, but they're in buildings, they're on streets, they're in shopping malls. They're virtually everywhere, so you simply can't go out without a camera on you, rolling, recording you. I mean, I'm just wondering when it'll be mandatory to stick one in your home so they can keep track of you there. I mean, who looks at this? In my building, there are cameras in the elevator. I think they're there to catch somebody committing vandalism, but if somebody were going to commit vandalism, it probably would be an outsider, and they'd have no idea who this person is. But every time I get in the elevator, the only thought that goes through my mind is, Big Brother is watching me.
Well, that's been going on for some time. I've wondered about this, and a question came up about the Boston Marathon on how do they get the right to put all those people in place, and then how do they get the right to go after AP reporters the way they did, and how do they get the right to build their huge billion-dollar structures in Utah in order to go through these kinds of surveillance processes so they can do it as instantaneously as they might. And the answer goes back, you recall, to the Patriot Act. And we had talked about this in the past, that there was a beginning of the total control at that point. And because I, at that time, I was running the academic affairs of the university and including the library, we were getting notices, you know, that this is action which is the institutions have to be knowledgeable about, because they could come in and they could seek information on my or any student's or any administrator's use of the library and the commercial tools that are used there to do your research and searchings, and your cell phones and your computer, and no person in a position of any authority, a reference librarian, for example, could notify the individual that they are being looked at by the FBI, that indeed they would be in turn, if they were to disclose such, in jeopardy of breaking the rules and regulations of the Patriot Act. And all of a sudden you realize that you're on call at any point to be so viewed by your government. And AP, all of a sudden, now that goes back to 2001. So now in 2013, AP and the public media have decided, we got a problem here, that somehow the government is not open and free and allowing us to do our jobs. And this is the most blatant example of this kind of intrusion by the government, so that the media had to deal with it. It could not avoid the reality that it was the target of Obama's Justice Department and what it is that they seek in the way of information. Because our government, our press is not what you would call an investigative press, and going to disclose and destroy the government. Not anytime soon, anyway.
Not at all, Bill. Hold that thought. We need to take a break. We'll do that, and we'll come right back. William Cook, discussing the Middle East, discussing what's going on in America, the kind of topics you hear on this program all the time. You hear them the way you need to hear them. You hear what really is going on, news and information that you really need to know. And my request to listeners is, tell other people about them. I think the regular listeners to this program, it's a little bit like preaching to the choir, but I feel I have an obligation to pass on real information to others. I hope listeners will do it as well, because we need as many people as possible knowing what's happening. It's our only chance to change things, Bill. Indeed, it really is the only chance.
Well, I think so. I wanted to kind of return a minute to the Syrian situation as a focus, in the sense that, as an academic anyway, I receive information about what some would call the other side. There is a global campaign of solidarity with the Syrian revolution. I'm not sure where the title came from, except that it is they have published a petition in support of the Syrian people. And they obviously have decided that there is need for this kind of expression of solidarity against the regime that they find to be offensive. And it might be pertinent to at least make some reference to this, because it's part of the confusion that we get in the United States about the complexity of this, which is not an easily determined affair. For example, in a section called Who We Are, intellectuals, academics, activists, artists, concerned citizens, social movements, we stand in solidarity with the Syrian revolution and people's struggle against dictatorship. And we call on people of the world to pressure the Syrian regime to end its oppression of and war on the Syrian people. We demand that Bashar al-Assad leave immediately without excuses so that Syria can begin a speedy recovery towards a democratic future. Now, there's not a whole lot to condemn in that point, assuming that you have no trouble getting Assad out, if it would be better for the people at large. The problem is, and they admit this later on in their petition, this is a revolt that was sparked by the children of Deraa and the sit-ins and demonstrations of the youth in the cities, the peasants in the rural areas, and the dispossessed and marginalized of Syria. Lately, however, this has resulted in attempts by some groups fighting the regime to force a climate of polarization and negation of the other politically, socially, and culturally. And that last statement seems to point to the reality that there are forces involved in the Syrian revolution, including 700 and some Germans that have left Europe to go fight in Syria. And the kind of people that are, in fact, engaged in the what are called the rebel forces, when, in fact, if you were to look at Robert Fisk and Dr. Fred Franklin Lamb, who reside there and have been writing about this for years now, realize that we have a whole lot of sectarian fighters present, and it's a war that's volatile and spreading, and the struggle between the forces that are funded and armed by outside sponsors, particularly, of course, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, including Sunni Salafists, anti-Western al-Qaeda fighters, those kinds of groups, seem to make the clarity of a fight for liberty and freedom by the peasants and the average citizens in the country be, how would you say this, not able to be defined so that there is a good side and a bad side, but there are factions that want to take whatever they can out of this for whatever benefit they get and make the potential of this a conflagration that could bring on a war, world war that would be devastating for all the reasons that we suggested in the first part of this program, where you have the major countries that are non-Western, Russia itself, obviously, Iran, China, the BRIC countries, and many, obviously, of the Arab countries against any coalition that could come from the West. And unless America were to somehow find a way of using its incredible force in a swift battle, something like Daddy Bush's 90-day war in Kuwait, there would be no real conclusive action that would result except mayhem and chaos that would go on for years after the initial start of it. And that, I think, is the dilemma that has forced Obama, at least, to try to have a dialogue with Russia. If Russia continues, and it should, from my perspective, include Iran, then it's going to be questionable whether Israel objecting to that will be able to prevent Obama from having that negotiated conference that could somehow make possible a resolution of this without going to outlandish war.
Bill, I've been very outspoken on the Syrian war. I've written so many articles about it. I lost count, literally dozens of articles over the past 2 years. This absolutely is a Washington plot to get rid of all the independent governments. The issue with Syria isn't the type of government it has, other than the fact that it's not controlled by Washington. That was the issue in Libya with Gaddafi, the same thing in Iraq. These are the countries that America targets. Venezuela is on the hit list. It was under Hugo Chavez. It remains so, as far as I can imagine, under Nicolas Maduro. Independent governments that simply don't want to take orders from Washington. And Wesley Clark, the NATO commander in 1999, who ravaged Yugoslavia, he was told by his Pentagon friends that there were war plans to knock off half a dozen or more countries in the region, and Libya, Iraq, Iran, Syria, they were among the countries, and he was astonished when he heard this. I don't know why. He was a warrior general. He knows what war is all about. He certainly had his own hands bloodied with what he did, but the comments that he made, and he wrote a book about it, Winning Modern Wars, and he went on. He was interviewed. I saw a videotape of him talking about it. But I couldn't imagine him asking a question like this. Are these people planning to attack us? That was basically the question that he asked. Well, he knew the answer to that. No, they're not planning to attack us. But
this gets us
went
into
on a
the new mapping of the Mideast, which is to move the state of Israel from being the size of Rhode Island to embrace Lebanon and over through Iraq to the Euphrates, and then go down all the way to the Sinai. I think they will try to take the Sinai Peninsula back. That kind of size would make possible the vision of the Israeli state and the United States representatives in Congress and whatnot that have bought into this kind of power base in the Mideast. Because they have been told it's absolutely necessary for the maintenance of the American empire if it is going to survive through this next century. And that is a vision that does not take into account the people that live there and how they will be destroyed in the process of making such a thing take place.
Bill, you're absolutely right. For at least the past few decades, Israel has had a scheme for a greater Israel. Israel is the only country in the world without fixed borders. Well, there's a reason for that, because Israel wants to expand them to the greatest extent possible. It'll gobble up anything it can get its hands on, whether it's Sinai, whether it's Jordan, whether it's Lebanon, mainly areas they want that have valued resources. So Israel occupies southern Lebanon 20 miles into the country from about 1982 to 2000. They wanted the water. There was a river there, the Litani River,
Litani,
and Israel was stealing Lebanon's water. They want to steal its offshore resources, gas and oil resources. They're stealing Palestine's resources off the coast of Gaza, gas, and where there's gas, there's oil, and where there's oil, there's gas. So you've got this scheme. And the other part of it is taking these other countries, the rival countries, and balkanizing them, chopping them up into ethnic groups or whatever, so letting Washington fight its wars for it. So Washington fought the Iraq war for it. It wants Washington to fight the Iran war for it. I wonder what will happen if they get into greater loggerheads with Turkey. They were not too friendly for a number of months because of the Mavi Marmara massacre back in May 2010, I believe.
That's
and now
right.
They're making up. Exactly what's going on, I'm not sure. There probably still is a little bit of friction between them, but they need each other. Turkey is a NATO country. Israel is a de facto NATO country. It's a Mediterranean region partner country, Mediterranean alliance partner country. So NATO, Israel is a de facto NATO country. You've got 28, you've got a number of partner countries. I think all of them rolled together, you've got about 50, and Israel is one of them. So when they go to war, they all support each other. And they just seem to want to fight one war after another, Bill. It just never ends, and it could end up in a terrible conflagration.
Well, I think Israel was kind of forced to consider apologizing to the Turkish government, because America needs Turkey as part of the NATO forces, and it needs them to somehow grapple with the people fleeing from Syria and aid them. And as a consequence, we needed Israel to make amends with Turkey. We couldn't have our best friend in the Mideast not able to talk and be friendly to that nation. Now, Turkey, you remember Erdogan at the World Economic Conference was absolutely angry at Perez for his comments at that conference, and playing the peace mender, and he simply stood up and told him, I'll never forget it, he said to him, "Sir, you know how to kill," and he walked off the stage. It was a moment that I think stands out, because he then, when Israel refused to admit any error in attacking the Mavi Marmara, he simply was livid and broke off connections with Israel as a result of that. That's one of the few countries that the population in Israel could go to and feel relatively secure. And they can't do that anymore, and it limits their mobility, which is rather difficult for them. America needs to have Turkey on board, or otherwise it would align itself against the forces of the West, that especially if Israel was part of it.
Oh, indeed, so, Bill. Did we get disconnected? If we did, let's get
and
Bill back.
Netanyahu has already said in interviews that he would expect the American military to take over because they know how to do it best, his comment. So he does not intend to send his IDF soldiers to be on the ground in any of these countries that he wants invaded. He wants the American soldiers there, and he's made it clear that that's exactly the case. And Wolfowitz has continued to push for America to be the army of Israel. And so we're finding that America will be made to do what it's told to do, because that's what our congressmen are willing to support, since they have been bought and paid for by this group. And you'll remember when Hagel was interviewed, how ferocious Lindsey Graham was as he tried to humiliate that man for having taken a stand at some point in his life against the controls which the AIPAC and the lobbies impose on our government. So it's not America's security that's being the vision of America's foreign policy. It is the security of that state which provides our congressmen with the means for them to stay in office. It's a degrading kind of understanding of what American democracy has become.
Bill, I wrote an article. I've written a lot about the Israeli lobby, and I wrote a recent one quoting some noted Americans, including military people. One was a former Joint Chiefs of Staff head, Admiral Thomas Mora. I believe his first name was Thomas Mora, and he was a Joint Chiefs head around the 1970s or so, and I don't have his quote in front of me. It was a rather long quote, but it really was an amazing quote where he said it's absolutely astonishing that Israel can literally twist the American tail and get no matter who leads this country, to get them to go along with the most outrageous policies. I mean, people just don't understand that this stuff is going on, but he knew a chapter and verse because it happened on his watch, and there were others that made similar comments, and it's so true, and very seldom does anybody come out publicly, especially while they're still in government, and dare criticize Israel. It's a kiss of death. And if a journalist does it in the major media, I mean, they could be sacked on the spot. They would never get back on air again. I once challenged the NewsHour, PBS NewsHour, the Lira NewsHour, they challenged me on an article I wrote about them that was completely one-sided, and I forget the precise topic, but they spotted my article, and their ombudsman contacted me, and he criticized me. Well, I politely answered him. I wrote what I know is factual, and I challenged him in return, and I said, well, I said, you present only one side of the story. I challenge you to put me on one of your programs. Let me be an alternate voice to these other people you put on. Well, I never heard another word back from him, and there was no surprise. They wouldn't dare put me on their program. I mean, the whole thing would go tilt.
Well, the reality is that PBS is as much controlled as the BBC relative to the issues regarding Israel. And it's rather fascinating to watch how this is done, because the process seems to be that if you can shame a person into the condition where they have to somehow say that something negative about Israel, they then become anti-Semitic just automatically. And that threat has held a lot of water for over the 65 years that Israel has been in existence. And I read an article just this past week that Balfour, when he was working with the Zionist World Organization to frame the Balfour Declaration, that what they did was to say to him, you can't deny the existence of Israel, because the people have been suffering over all of these centuries, and there's such a need to provide them with a safe haven where they can live. And Balfour apparently was not a particularly favored member of the Zionist group, but they were able to force him, so to speak, out of shame, to go along with this concept. And they use this now in order to push a similar kind of agenda. If somebody is negative, they go and they talk not about the correctness of what they have written, but rather, how can you write this about a people who have a right to exist in a safe place so that they do not get maligned so often or victimized so often? And that becomes a means of control, and people capitulate because they don't want to be seen as anti-Semitic. And it's not anti-Semitism that is going on here, because in fact what you write and what I write and what those who are working on behalf of some kind of justice ultimately for the Palestinian people and for others in the Mideast is to provide accurate information. And if that's going to call the callers of anti-Semitism to the forefront, that's fine. But you did exactly what any one of us would try to do: point to where we are in error and then tell us about the problem. Don't just call names and in generalizations claim this person is not a qualified person to talk about this or that. And the result is that you find that that's all they can do. They can't deny the reality of what is a truth.
Well, they can't deal, and I certainly support the right of all people to be free from oppression and to know that they're in a nation where the laws will protect them and the government will protect them. But to set aside one group of people, whether it's Jews or anybody else, and give them special rights. Well, in the same part of the world, of course, what about the Palestinians? What about the Kurds in Turkey, in northern Iraq? I guess they have. I don't know what rights they have in northern Iraq. They certainly don't have many in Turkey, but the Kurds have always been denied. Nobody talks about them, but so many other peoples around the world, their rights are denied. So the idea that you single out one and ignore so many others, this just doesn't wash. So this bothers me a great deal. And to call anybody critical of Israel, as I am, anti-Semitic, that doesn't wash. Bill, we're almost out of time. Let me give you the last thought.
Okay, well, I think if you look back over the past 65 years, you'll find that the union of the United States policies with that of Israel has been devastating to the United States. And I don't know how anyone can claim that there has been a greater peace and security as a result of this union. Israel has attacked Syria this past 2 weeks, and no one says anything about it, but it's an act of war, and we should condemn it as a nation, because that's exactly what we would want done if someone were to attack us. And we have allowed them to invade Lebanon in 2006. They have authorization from us to attack and invade Gaza and to go into the West Bank and to steal more land. None of this is democratic. None of it is for justice and peace. And it seems to me that we should be looking at the reality of this affiliation, not at a make-believe set of lies.
Absolutely. But we are out of time. I've got to end the program. But I agree with you right down the line. My great thanks, Bill, for coming on. I look forward to getting you back. Join us, listeners, next week, Fridays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.